You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome in hour two of the Mike Allen Show here on this Monday, October 31st, All Hallows Eve. Tomorrow, of course, feast day of All Saints. All you holy men and women, pray for us. It's also known to Protestant Christians, at least the well-informed, as Reformation Day, because it was on this day, 499 years ago now, 1517, that the Augustinian monk and priest Martin Luther, in protest to what he saw as a corruption in the Catholic Church and distortions of the gospel message, nailed 95 theses to the door at the Wittenberg Cathedral. Now, some of that is, a little bit of what do you call it, hagiography or popular mythology and all the rest. We'll get Joe Kopech, who was raised Catholic, became a Lutheran pastor, and now has re-entered with his family and his wife, who entered the Catholic Church, now is a pastoral associate at a large parish here, recently off an appearance on Marcus Grody's The Journey Home. But Joe, who trained as Lutheran pastor, will help us understand what Martin Luther got right and what he got wrong. And so we'll get into all that a little bit later in the show. 573-4-BREAD-4, if you want to be a part of it, if you've got a question or a comment, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. We'll also, of course, spin the Dollar Catechism wheel today and talk about some other things today, including C.S. Lewis and the Happiness Guru and why it's all about the right reward. I'm asking a question of the day. It's that time of year where people began to think about things like seances and Ouija boards and all the rest, all the things that go with horror movies and the demonic and ideas of possession and all the rest, and sharing a little bit from an article I just posted on the show's Facebook page from the Real Clear Religion website on the sinister origins or how the Ouija board got its sinister reputation. I'm asking a question of whether as a child you ever played around with a Ouija board or did a seance or anything like that. And if so, did you have any weird experiences? As I said, you can call, you can post on Facebook or Twitter. Some responses we've gotten on Facebook. Christy says, I'm scared to death of all that. Even reading stories about it worries me, so no. Anna says, I like games, and as a teenager, I bought a deck of tarot cards. After reading the instruction book and the meaning of the cards, I played fortune teller with some friends. Maybe coincidence, but many revelations were true to the extent that I gave that game up. AJ says his mother would have tanned his hide. And his mother chimes in and says, my grandmother gave me a tongue lashing when I was a kid for playing with one. Then as an adult, I had a friend whose house burned to the ground. They lost everything except a Ouija board that was hidden away in a closet that remained unharmed. Better to stay away from that. Tom said, I had my tarot cards read once by some random woman in a bar. My fortune, you're a man in search of a philosophy. Duh, he says. I was like 24 years old. Anyway, I'll share maybe more comments later in the program. Today's readings, we're now into St. Paul's letter to the Philippians, the beautiful chapter 2 that talks about having the mind of Christ. We'll actually miss the what's considered to be an early hymn to Christ and his self-emptying. The rest of Philippians chapter 2, because tomorrow's reading will be supplanted by the All Saints Day readings. But today, St. Paul, brothers and sisters, if there is any encouragement in Christ, any solace in love, any participation in the Spirit, any compassion and mercy, complete my joy by being of the same mind, with the same love, united in heart, thinking one thing. Do nothing out of selfishness or out of vainglory. Rather, humbly regard others as more important than yourselves, each looking out not for his own interests, but also everyone for those of others. What struck me about that reading particularly was St. Paul's exhortation to them to be a community of love and humility and self-giving. Why? Because it would complete his joy. Complete my joy, he says, by being of the same mind. St. Paul, in the communities in which he was in ministry, was so vested. Now, he was writing this, of course, from jail. It's one of the prison epistles, his letter to the Philippians, and yet it's a book that radiates with joy. But you see that even in the midst of his chains, what brought him joy, in fact, was to see unity. You know, we talk about, as we'll talk about with Joe Kopack a little bit, the terrible rending of Christian unity, particularly in the West, that came through the Protestant Reformation, that we're now on the cusp of celebrating. I'm kind of making air quote signs here, celebrating 500 years. I think there has been a lot of movement over the last, let's say, 50 years, movements toward some healing of this great rift that has so wounded Christ's body, but so much farther to go, and sometimes it feels like two steps forward, three steps back. Unity, what our Lord prayed for, the knowledge that he has one church, as it's been said before, unity is not something we achieve, it's a gift we receive. But our Lord prayed so fervently that the unity experienced between the Father and the Son and united together and the beauty and the power of the Holy Spirit would be reflected in his body on earth, and our divisions are a scandal. St. Paul taking on that mindset that it would be in their unity brought about by humility and self-giving that would bring him joy. We know what this is, even as parents. I can remember as a child when my sisters and I would fight, and man, we had some humdingers. And of course, I was always the innocent victim of my two sisters. Don't ask them. They'll give you a different story. But when we would fight, I can remember, it's one of the few times in my life that I can remember my dad genuinely anguished about something. It really bothered him to see his children not getting along, fighting. It was more than just frustration at an irritation at the noise and having to make peace. It genuinely anguished him. Now, as a parent, I understand that. Yesterday was one of the coolest things for me because, you know, my children are all getting to be, I've got some adult children now and, others who are more mature in their thinking. And when my oldest daughter's home visiting now for a few days. So we have everybody there except my son, who's off in this Challenge Academy. December 10th, please God, he'll be graduating and coming home. But six of them there, and I was kind of occupied with something else, but I was attuned enough to their conversation. They began to really talk together about spiritual things. It was about faith-related things. It was good for me to see. Because believe me, we're an imperfect family. We're a normal family, you know, kids buried in devices and, you know, electronic devices and all the rest, and fights and strivings and jealousies and tear-filled moments and all that stuff. To have a moment in which they seemed to be of one mind was, I don't know, it brought this father's heart some serious joy, a little bit of hope. A little hope's good for the soul, you know what I mean? But it's all about St. Paul's joy. Now, so speaking of joy, we look at the gospel reading for today. Luke chapter 14. Jesus goes on the Sabbath to dine at the home of one of the leading Pharisees. You notice that Jesus certainly, yes, ate with tax collectors and sinners, but he also ate with people of reputation. He was loving and to all. All did not receive that love, unfortunately. Anyway, and we said to the host who invited him, when you hold a lunch or a dinner, do not invite your friends or your brothers or sisters or your relatives or your wealthy neighbors, in case they may invite you back and you have repayment. Rather, when you hold a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind. Blessed indeed will you be because of their inability to repay you. For you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. I think the interesting thing here, and of course you always have to be careful you don't read too much into a parable, but this is consonant with other things that Jesus has said in that, and we've talked about C.S. Lewis a little bit today. He was one who pointed this out. We don't need to be ashamed of seeking reward. Because in this parable, for example, Jesus, in essence, says, look, those who invite those to the dinner that can pay them back, their reward is what it is. It's in this life. It is limited, of course. It is conditional and so forth. But when you invite those who cannot pay you back in this world, you will be repaid. It's akin to what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 6 was instructions about not praying to impress others, that those who stand out on street corners and pray impressive prayers, they had, what did Jesus say? They have received their reward. In other words, it's as good as it's going to get. But when you pray, go into secret where your Father alone is, and He will repay you. So, as C.S. Lewis said, there's nothing wrong about seeking reward. It's not some sort of a corruption of the motives of Christianity. It's understanding what the reward is that we seek. And the reward we seek is eternal bliss and joy. There's no shame in that. In fact, as Lewis said, our desires aren't too strong. They're too weak. We settle. There's a greater reward to come. Later in the show, I want to get back into this because of an interesting piece I saw about the whole essence of joy and why it should be central to what we pursue as disciples. We'll be back in a minute with my friend Joseph Kopeck. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Monday, October 31st, All Hallows Eve, or known to some of our Protestant brothers and sisters as Reformation Day. I'm here with my good friend in the studio, Joe Kopeck. Joe, who is the pastoral associate at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Church, a parish here in Lexington, Kentucky, where we broadcast from, where he lives and serves there with his wife, Beth, who entered the church when Joe came back to the church, and along with their children. So, Joe, good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you today.
Yeah, good to be here.
Tell me your kids' names, because I don't know those.
John and Kate.
John and Kate.
Yep.
Fantastic. So, and they're little martial arts experts.
They are, yeah. My son takes karate lessons here in town, and then, of course, we just had a talent show at St. Louis Van Seton, where I'm the a pastoral associate, and so he did a display of his karate skills, and my daughter is now saying that she wants to be in the talent show next year, because, you know, brother got a lot of attention, so.
Yeah, have they moved up to cinder blocks yet, or?
We tried to convince him to do that, but he's like, I don't know.
That is a little bit dangerous, though. I mean, unless you're a martial arts expert, too.
Yeah, you could hurt yourself. Yeah, and they do something when they do their belt test where they break boards. And people occasionally do hurt themselves. Not bad, but they do hurt themselves.
Wow.
Little bruised knuckles and those kinds of things. So far, I haven't seen any broken bones, but, you know, maybe next week.
Well, you probably wanted to break a few boards watching your cubbies this weekend, though they're still alive.
Yes, it's painful. It's one of those, I love to watch the Cubs when they're winning. It's hard to watch when they're losing, because, you know, it's just too much for me, too intense.
Well, you've watched that a lot over the years.
Yeah, I know. Well, especially when they're in a place like this. You know, when the season's bad and you're like, okay, maybe they'll win, maybe they won't, you know. But when you get to the point where they could finally win a World Series, you know.
It's So you're a true diehard. I mean, you're not a bandwagon hopper. I mean, you've been with the Cubs for
A long time. I started when I was at Center College watching the Cubs on WGN. And so back when Mark Grace was first baseman, and I remember the season where they went 0-17 to start the season. So, yeah, I'm a diehard.
You're truly dedicated.
Been a Cubs fan for a long, long time. I remember 2003, you know, being angry for about 2 weeks when, you know, they lost in the NLCS. So it's happened before. I think being a Cubs fan teaches you a lot about faith. It's all about patience, long-suffering.
Redemptive suffering, hopefully.
Yes, redemptive, hopefully. And remaining hopeful, even though there are signs to the
contrary. So I have to ask you this, and I know this isn't our main topic today, but I got to ask a true Cubs fan this. Is it more painful to expect little and then have that happen, or to expect much, get as close, as tantalizingly close as you can get if they were to lose game 6 or 7 in Cleveland, which is tougher?
I think what's tougher is this year, like, them being this close and going, okay, don't blow this, guys. You know, it's when they're playing really poorly, you're like, all right, whatever. You know, it's the Cubs, and they're just not playing well this year. My joke about the Cubs manager is they always do every interview the same way. You know, no matter what they talk about, whether they're playing well or they're playing poorly, they can always say, well, there's plenty of time to turn that around.
Yeah, that's right.
So,
well, the Indians have their own drought, so we'll see how it all plays out.
Yeah,
for sure. But anyway, thanks for being here. So just to give a little quick synopsis of your story again, mm-hmm. for those, I know you've told it before on the show, and you recently were on The Journey Home, which is people can watch that on YouTube.
On YouTube, yeah. Journey Home, Joe Kopech, and you can.
I'll try to make sure I put a link up. Of that, maybe during a break, I can put a link up on the show's Facebook page too, which is a lot of fun up in Zanesville, Ohio. And so your story, you were cradle Catholic, but somewhat nominal. Is that right?
Yeah. My parents were what I call identity Catholics, Polish Catholics that, you know, we're Catholic, but we don't really go to church all that often. There was a lot of heritage, a lot of claiming of that Catholic heritage, but not a lot of living out of that on a daily basis. And then eventually they fell away from the church around the time that I was middle school, high school. Like, I never went to confirmation classes or any of those kinds of things, but still, you know, kind of had that in the back of my head of faith and wrestling with where's God calling me to be. And then when I went to college is when I'd kind of fallen away from the church almost completely by then. But when I went to Center College, I started studying biblical languages as a part of thinking that I would want to be a religion professor. You know, I thought I would just be writing, you know, great books and that kind of thing, until I realized how hard that is to actually do.
Right.
You can write books, but writing great books is much more difficult. So anyway, was dating a girl who was Lutheran at the time, and she said, well, you should try going to the Lutheran church. So I ended up going to Lutheran church, and one thing kind of led into another of becoming a Lutheran pastor, and enjoyed it. 9 years as a Lutheran pastor. Served two parishes, one in southern Indiana, one in Georgia near Savannah. And around the time my son was born, 2007, is when that journey really started to kind of kick in, or that questioning of, is this where God's calling me to be ultimately? I think whenever you have children, that makes you reflect on your life in a different way. And so that began that process. And then over the course of several more years, became convinced that, yeah, I needed to come home to the Catholic Church, which was good and bad. It was good in the sense of finally knowing where God was calling me to be, and feeling very confident that was where God was going to be, wants me to be. But the, you know, obviously the issues of work and then my wife being a born and raised Lutheran, never having considered being anything else, that was a big change for her to even contemplate. So, I came back in 2011. She came in Easter of 2012.
Wow.
So she went through the RCIA process and said, yeah, this is for me too.
You know, they say, Joe, that, you know, for people who become Catholic, you know, from a Protestant background, I've came, of course, out of a Methodist background, and then, you know, others, that, you know, sometimes the metaphor for that is called swimming the Tiber. You know, the Tiber's that river in Rome. And, but it's been said, you know, that the Tiber's wider in some places than in others, right?
Right.
So, you know, for an Anglican, let's just say, not nearly as wide as it would be for a Southern Baptist, let's right. say, or a Disciples of Christ.
Or Pentecostal or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Now, it's interesting from as a Lutheran, right? Mm-hmm. You a liturgical faith, right? And used to many
primarily,
things.
Yes.
But at the same time, I'm imagining, particularly as a Lutheran pastor, mm-hmm. a lot of your formation, you were steeped in Luther and what he was doing, what the Reformation right. was all about.
Right.
That might broaden that river even wider, I would think, in some ways.
In some ways it did, in some ways it didn't. It's one of those weird dynamics because in many ways Luther and Lutheranism is very Catholic, small c. Historically, holding on to the liturgy, holding on to the sense of lectionary, the liturgical calendar, those kinds of things.
A high view of the Eucharist, I guess.
High view of the Eucharist, holding on to a lot of Catholic faith tradition in a lot of ways, with obviously some changes to that. But there's a lot of similarities, should be a lot of love there. And there is in some ways, but at the same time, it's sort of like I always describe it as sort of like family members, you know, who have a feud going on. You know, two brothers who something's happened, and that hatred or that animosity becomes so intense, even though they should be really close, they're not. Mm. And even though they've come and spent time together at the family reunion, and that relationship is maybe healed a little bit. It's so hard to recover from that initial incident that caused the break to begin with. I think that's a good analogy for where Lutherans are with Catholics and in terms of the some of the ecumenical efforts and efforts towards unity.
I'm here with Joe Kopeck, who is a pastoral associate at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Parish in Lexington, where we broadcast from, a former Lutheran pastor, cradle Catholic, somewhat nominal, drifted away from the church, became a Lutheran Christian and a Lutheran pastor, and then found his way back into the Catholic Church, and his family joined him as well. We're talking a little bit here on the 499 years of
right.
the... Now tell me, the whole story of Luther with the 95 Theses and nailing the door. I mean, in Lutheran understanding, I mean, how historically accurate is that?
Well, yeah, that's the one of the problems. It's one of those, did this really happen, or is this just a story that arose? And the problem you have with Luther is there are tons of stories like that.
Oh, yeah.
Luther said this. Well,
tossing the inkwell across the room at the demons and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, and there's, there were supposedly people who sort of disciples of his who followed him around and wrote everything down that he said. There's works you can buy called Luther's Table Talks, where he was just sitting around drinking a beer and talking to these other students, and they wrote down things he said. But, it's kind of like Yogi Berra, some of the things I said, I never said. So there's a lot of question marks about what really happened. Like with the 95 Theses, did he really do this or not? And, there's a movie called Luther that came out a couple years ago with Ralph Fiennes or Joseph Fiennes. I can't remember which one of the Fiennes brothers it was. But, and it's got the dramatic scene where he pulls out the parchment and he comes down and nails it to the church door, which is, a beautiful image. And Lutherans see that and are like, yes, there's the moment it all started. Now, whether or not that historically happened, there's some questions. One of the problems, though, is that it wasn't, it's seen as this sort of, Luther taking this bold move of nailing these 95 disputes with church teaching onto the door, but back then people hung stuff on church doors all the time. It was almost like the bulletin board. That if you wanted to find out what was going on,
kind of the Facebook of its day.
Yeah, it was where you posted things and said, hey, this is something I want to be discussed or whatever. So
we'll have to continue this on the sure. other side of the break here with my good friend Joe Kopeck. If you've got a question or a comment, 573-4BREAD-4. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hallows Eve, known for known to some of our Protestant brothers and sisters as Reformation Day. I'm here with my good friend Joe Kopeck, a cradle Catholic, a former Lutheran pastor, and revert to the Catholic faith. We're talking a little bit about what Luther got right and what he got wrong. So was it when you were a Lutheran pastor, was Reformation Day a big deal?
It was a big deal, yeah. And actually, one of the things that I was thinking about in the last couple of days leading up to this was, you know, we as a Lutheran pastor, we always celebrated the last Sunday before, the last Sunday of October. It was sort of, you know, Catholics transfer feast days, right? So this past Sunday, instead of being the 32nd Sunday in Ordinary Time, or as they would call it, I can't remember, or I don't think they called it Ordinary Time. I think it was after Pentecost.
Oh, yes.
Sundays after Pentecost. But instead of being that, it was that those readings were thrown out and you brought in the Reformation Sunday readings. So, you know, you got to hear John's, I think I mentioned that in the Facebook message I sent to you, was there was sort of a triumphalistic reading of John's gospel, you know, you shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free. you know, so there was this sense of, you know, we have the truth and we, you know, we announced the truth to the Catholic Church and stood up to the church. And
you got your brass and they're playing the opening hymn. Bum, bum, bum,
right.
Bum,
oh, yeah.
Bum, 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 bum.
Yeah, I'm Feisterberg,
Were you surprised to find that in the Catholic hymnal when you came in?
Absolutely, absolutely.
A Mighty Fortress.
I remember when we came into the church, it was this weird moment of, you know, like Twilight Zone. You know, we're standing there at Mass and, you know, they're like, announce the next hymn in Mass. And it's a Mighty Fortress. And I like looked over at Beth. I'm going, what's going on? I'm like, the Catholics, they like Luther now? What, you know, it was surreal. So I think one of the things that's interesting about that is some of those rifts that have been there aren't there in the same way that they were in the past.
Sure.
Now, there is some anti-Catholicism in Lutheranism. Don't get me wrong. But there's a lot of Lutherans who are like, oh, you know, Catholics and Lutherans, we can get along fine. And, you know, they even treasure some things about Catholicism. I know a lot of Lutherans who will go on retreats at Catholic retreat centers, you know, have good relationships with the local Catholic parish, maybe do things together from time to time. Those rifts have healed a little bit in the last, you know, 30-40 years.
Right. So, yeah, since probably the Second Vatican Council and right. Some communication and some discovery that perhaps some of our disagreements were about terminology. Not all of them, but some of them were.
Yeah.
For sure.
And on some things we were a lot closer with Catholics are a lot closer to Lutherans or Lutherans are a lot closer to Catholics than what we thought.
Right.
And I'll give you a good example of that, you know, when we talk about the Eucharist. And one of the things that's difficult for me as someone who's come back to the Catholic Church and is normally associated with Protestantism in general, people will say, well, Protestants don't believe in the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. And to a large extent, that's true within Protestantism in general. But Luther talked about Christ being truly present.
Oh, yeah.
The language was different, in, with, and under. And part of his issue was some of the philosophical sorts of underpinnings of transubstantiation, and you know, he was a little skeptical about how far we could go with this sort of metaphysical or rational.
And to be fair, there are Orthodox Christians who would also have some struggles
right.
with transubstantiation. The
right.
idea, right?
So, right. Yeah, and I think one of the things we're talking about things he got right. One of the things that Luther got right was to restore a little bit of a mystery to this. There's Christ is present in this, but we don't fully understand how. We don't fully understand what this miracle is that takes place each time we celebrate the Mass. I think he would agree with that, and I think that's one of the things that Catholics sometimes can get into is a little bit of, oh, you know, let's understand exactly the mechanics or the physics behind this and how it works. And I think sometimes if we do that, we can begin to miss the point of that God has done this marvelous thing.
Mm.
And I was thinking of the other day of the hymn, Let All Mortal Flesh Fall Silent.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's a place where, you know, maybe that's what we should do. Instead of trying to explain it, we should just go, I can't.
Would they practice in Lutheran tradition, would Eucharistic adoration, would that be something
No. Well, and especially not historically.
Right.
You know, one of the problems you also have in Lutheranism and Protestantism in general is you have what's taught, what's part of your theology,
right,
and what's practiced.
Right.
So it's one of the issues that for me was part of my journey was, and you know, in the Lutheran churches that I served as a pastor, you know, what would we do when we celebrated communion? You know, you'd have a host, you would say the words institution, you'd have the wine there, you'd say the words institution, and it was supposed to be this is Christ.
Right.
That's what we talked about. That's what we believed.
A mutual friend we have as a Lutheran pastor used to always say, you know, what is, you know, to borrow President Clinton's words, you know, what does is, you know,
right,
what
right.
does is mean, right? Because
right.
he said, this is my body.
Yeah.
Right?
And that's one of the things where, you know, where I think Luther said, and I think he had some there was something good here. You know, Jesus made this promise.
Right.
That this is my body. And that should be enough for us to say, okay, Jesus wants to share himself with us. That what a beautiful thing. The problem is, you know, practically versus what we hold theologically, and Catholics have this too, by the way, we certainly have this issue as well. But the practical side of it was, well, what did you do with these hosts after your mm-hmm. communion service in the Lutheran church? You know, often in the churches that I served, it was the host went back in a Ziploc bag. The wine got poured back in the bottle and put back in the refrigerator. That was it. There was no sense of that this holy thing that we're supposed to be treasuring remains holy. And as a matter of fact, some Lutherans had something went into this sort of, you know, what would really be a heresy. It was a sort of a receptionism. You know, this is the body of Christ when I receive it.
Oh, I see.
But
yeah.
when I, you know, as soon as we're not receiving anymore, it stops being the body of Christ, which kind of, how does that work? Again, go back to the mystery of, well, this is my body. Well, then what? How does that work? And then also, how do we treasure this as a holy thing? So I think there's the adoration. Most Lutherans would sort of see that as an idolatry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're worshiping this monstrance, you know, and part of the, you know, part of the problem is the terminology, you know, especially for people who are not totally familiar with the origin of words, you know, then, oh, you're going to worship a monstrance? What? You know, and again, it would go into a sort of an idolatrous. And I remember for me as coming back into the church, the first time I went to adoration, it was sort of like, I didn't necessarily have a problem with it theologically. I knew where what was supposed to be going
right.
on, but it was still not only a culture shock, but there was still a moment when I looked around at other people and went, we're just going to sit here and be quiet. And there's supposed to be something. What are we looking at? You know,
right.
And not having a full understanding of that gift. And now I love adoration when I get a chance to go to.
I'm here with my good friend, Joe Kopech, a Catholic revert, former Lutheran pastor. We're talking about Reformation Day. I guess they're going to be a lot of celebrations. I'm making air quotes there over
right.
the next 500 years.
Right.
You know, one of the issues about why Luther got right and wrong, you know, one of the big things that comes up with Luther and the Protestant Reformation is this whole relationship between faith and works, right? And,
right.
And
absolutely. Yeah.
Luther's protest that he, I guess maybe he thought the church had drifted over into maybe sort of a Pelagianism to where we earn our salvation through works.
Right.
Whereas he, you know, sola fide was one of his rallying cries, right?
Right.
The faith alone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the joint declaration that came out in the 90s, I think,
yeah,
between the
90...
Catholics and Lutherans.
93, 95, I can't remember.
Helped settle that there were some differences that were a matter of terminology. That, in other words,
right.
as Catholics, we can affirm faith alone
mm-hmm.
as long as, I mean, we can, as long as we understand what we mean by faith.
Right.
Do we mean a cognitive assent or do we mean active faith working itself out in love? If it's the latter, we can affirm
right.
faith alone.
Right. And that's one of the things that's also difficult is, you know, the terminology, you know, we have to get down into the weeds of what does this mean when we say this? You know, what do you mean when you say it versus what the, you know, what I'm trying to say? And that's, again, that's historically one of the problems we, you know, Lutherans and Catholics have had is there are times when I think in essence, we were saying the same thing. We're coming at the you know, the same, describing the same picture from different angles, but we're really trying to describe the same thing, and we would agree on what the thing is. Going back to the, you know, the definition of is, we agree on what it is, but that language has gotten in the way, and it became to the point where, you know, we couldn't be in the same room together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I had a Lutheran friend who's now Catholic. He teaches at a Catholic university in Washington, and he said, you know, like his one of the things was the Eucharist. Is to a certain extent, he said, we're at the point where we both agree that it's a coat, but we disagree on what shade of color it is. You know, and that's how close, but also how far apart we are.
Like the dress going around the internet there for a while.
Yeah,
about what color?
Yeah, yeah. Wait, what color is this dress? Yeah. And you know, the problem with that is of course those things get played out in this very animated way, and I think part of what Luther was trying to get us to understand as Catholics is that there were some things that were really wrong in the church, and hopefully we get a chance to talk more
about
that.
Absolutely. We'll be back in just a minute with more. We'll continue this conversation with my good friend Joe Kopeck. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media. If you've got a question, email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this All Hallows Eve, here with my good friend Joe Kopeck, Catholic, cradle Catholic, Lutheran pastor, and revert to the Catholic faith. We're talking a little bit about Reformation Day, which is on this day in 1517, a recognition 499 years ago, heading into the 500th anniversary next October of Luther, Martin Luther, the Augustinian monk and priest, nailing his 95 theses of protest at the Wittenberg Cathedral. We're talking a little bit about what Luther got right and wrong. It's been said by one particular Catholic, Carl Adam, wrote a book that I read. He said that if Luther had been content with reform, which the church always needs,
right,
still needs, then he would go down as one of our great saints, maybe even another Saint Boniface, you know, in Germany. But somewhere along the line, it went from reform to revolt or rejection of.
Right, right.
And that's the problem.
And I think there were a lot of factors that went into that. And you know, one of the things that I value is Luther talked about the command about bearing false witness. And you know, if you look in the Catechism, the Catholic Church says something very similar, but the idea of putting the best possible construction on your neighbor's actions.
Mm.
That you know, when we look at someone, we should try to say, okay, here's how my best possible way of understanding what their motives might have been, rather than simply jumping straight to, oh, they had a bad motivation. Now, sometimes that's the case, of course, and we need to name that. But you know, to use that with Luther and the Reformation, you know, I think his initial drive was to address some real abuses going on in the church.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about this during one of the breaks. You know, he went to Rome and saw some of the true abuses that were going on, you know, priests with girlfriends and all these crazy things that were going on that were, you know, okay, this isn't, you know, the church is teaching one thing and living out the faith in a different way, you know, living in a way that's counter to what they're teaching. And the same thing with indulgences, that, you know, the whole idea of selling an indulgence. And I can't remember the name of the guy just now.
But Tetzel.
Tetzel, who was preaching, you know, every time a coin in the coffer rings, a soul from purgatory springs. You know, and it was this sort of idea, if you put money in, you can get your relatives out of purgatory. And he painted purgatory as this place of hell where people are burning in torment. And, you know, there was real abuses going on. And even the Catholic Church could look back and go, yeah, yeah, we yeah, there were some things going on that were not in accord with what the church needed to be doing. And they could look at it from sure. that perspective. So I think there's some things he got right in that. Even his 95 Theses, you know, it wasn't written as, you know, here are the 95 reasons why I reject the Catholic Church and I want to form my own.
Right.
That's not what he was saying. The 95 Theses, what those are, 95 points of discussion. Here's 95 things that I think are wrong, and I want us to meet and talk about them and discuss them and come to some resolution on them. That's the way it was done is in academic circles of the day, was you would lay out, here are the things that I think are wrong, or here are the points that I want to discuss. And then the other group could look at that and go, okay, let me formulate our answers or responses to those things. And then you would have that academic and to some extent beyond academic discussion.
And it would, yeah. And then what happened is, I guess, too, some of the machinery involving others and political influences and everything got involved, and
right,
there was
right.
sort of no going back.
Well, and there was part of it is when we look at the Reformation as the sort of everything in the church was good up until Luther came along, and then Luther came up with these 95 Theses and some of his other works and blew the church apart. And that's not really looking at history very well,
right?
In the sense of there were things that were going on well before Luther came along.
Luther was not the first reformer, so to speak.
No, he was not. And you know, what's funny is that the when we were in Georgia, one of the local Lutheran churches is very, very old, Jerusalem Lutheran Church. If you look it up, it's this little community called New Ebenezer, because old Ebenezer was abandoned because it was too much in the swamp. And the church was built in 1760 something. I mean, it's still their original building. The old Salzburgers, and that's a part of the history, is the Salzburgers were a group of people who the local prince declared that everyone in that territory had to be Catholic. And they said, we want, you know, we're Lutheran. And so they left. They first went to England and then eventually came to the United States. But, you know, part of that church is on the very top is the swan. And there's Jan Hus who wrote the, who had a campaign to translate the Bible into the vernacular, and was eventually
burned at the stake
for that.
Right.
And the church could look back on that and go, yeah, that was not a good thing. Because the problem is that it got related into political things and power structures. And that's part of what we talked about during one of the breaks was, I think it was sort of a perfect storm when Luther came along. It wasn't just the printing press, although people say that. I think it was all these other political factors that really enhanced and intensified the conflict, because it became more than just what does the church teach and how should we live out our faith. It became the implications of this are for what political structures would be in place, who would be the prince in this territory or that territory. And of course, you know, the history of the Reformation was partly about religion and faith issues, but it was also about power.
Sure.
And Henry VIII, you know, his whole thing was about power. It wasn't I hope I don't offend anyone who's Anglican or Episcopal today, but you know, one of the things I always wrestled with Anglicanism in general was, you know, its start was really about what Henry VIII wanted to do, what he wanted to do.
Right.
There wasn't a theological conflict that created Anglicanism. And, you know, that's not really part of the history. It wasn't like they first said, oh, we disagree on this, let's
right.
And it was really about Henry VIII saying, I want to do what I want to do, and I want to be in charge of religion in my country. And then, of course, that blew into you know, part of the Reformation.
As we're moving toward, because we're moving, you know, toward the 500th anniversary right next year, and interestingly enough, you know, Pope Francis has been involved some. I think he's going to Sweden, you know,
right,
this week
right.
and everything. Mm-hmm. Is that a little odd for you as a Catholic to see that, you know, as somebody who was a Lutheran pastor who made the decision to become Catholic, and to see, you know, that this almost positivity
right.
surrounding these events?
It's not odd in the sense of part of what I love about being Catholic is part of what it means to be Catholic is to be universal, to say that we can look at all of God's creation and find elements of the truth there.
Mm-hmm.
We can find elements of beauty there that can be brought forward, that could be understood in the light of Christ, and then transformed. So that, you know, there's you know, even if you look at a pagan culture, you can go, okay, well, your desire to treat the environment in this way is a laudable thing, and the Catholic Church can agree with that. The traditions of honoring the dead in some cultures, you know, the church would look at that and say, well, yeah, we have something to that as well, where we look back to the saints. We honor All Souls. Mm. I mean, obviously All Souls is coming up. So there, you know, the church has always looked at those things and then brought them forward and transformed them and had a desire to do that. So it's not odd from that perspective. I think what's odd about it is, and I know that this was true when the Joint Declaration came out. I know this is true with some other things that have happened. Is how are these things going to be responded to?
Right.
Because that's one of the issues that I struggle with as a Lutheran was when we talked about an ecumenical desire or a desire towards unity. Lutherans had this understanding and from Luther that was the sadist S. It is sufficient or it is enough. And the rest of that phrase was, it is enough that the gospel is rightly preached and the communion is rightly celebrated. I mean, it was the idea of, you know, if you're preaching the gospel and you're celebrating the communion, that's enough. The problem with that is, what does that mean? Again, go back to what does that mean? So, you know, you could say, well, as long as they're preaching the gospel, as long as they're celebrating communion, they're fine. And of course, even in Lutheranism, that caused problems because you could look at some Lutheran churches that had abandoned the liturgical calendar, had abandoned a lot of church tradition, in favor of maybe a church growth model or some other kinds of things. And, you know, well, it's enough. It's we're still one with them, even though there was very, very little that held you in common. And it's one of the things I love about being Catholic is, you know, if I go to Mass in France, I'm going to understand what's going on. I may not understand what they're saying exactly, but I'll have a good sense of what is happening in the Mass
right.
at that moment. And there's a great deal of unity there. The problem you have in Protestant tradition, and especially in Lutheran tradition, is because they've been given this freedom from this sadist S, it's enough for us to be one that we do these things. People take all sorts of license with that.
Sure.
And then that's where all sorts of issues come about. And especially even in the ecumenical realm, because one of the things that you may not know about Lutherans is Lutherans and Episcopals have been doing a lot of dialogue about unity. And so they even came out, well, part of the agreements that they worked towards was an agreement on what's called full communion, where, you know, you can receive the Eucharist at the Episcopal Church, and then they can receive the Eucharist at a Lutheran church. And we agree on that this is the Eucharist, and then we also agree that this is... that both of these pastors or priests have the authority to do this.
Wow.
And there's some good things there. The downside is they made that agreement without really fleshing out what that meant.
Right. Joe Kopeck, Joe, always the fastest hour in radio. Thanks for coming. We got to have you back on again to talk about some more of these issues.
Yeah.
All right. This is the Mike Allen Show. Have a great rest of your day. Be back with you tomorrow, All Saints Day. This is the Mike Allen Show.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.